beyond prediction. Put away that phone now, or you may find yourself in a bit of despair. And now to our main event. You may know him from such films as Twister, Saw, Liar Liar, Robin Hood, Men in Tights. Some of his TV credits are Seinfeld, Psych, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Stranger Things, as well as the blockbuster Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, and more recently, Gus Van Sant's Dead Man's Wire. He has a new show called MIA, premiering on, can I say the name of another network here, Ed? I know we're here for Netflix, but this is on Peacock. MIA on Peacock on May 7th. It premieres in just a few days. But if you're here tonight, you no doubt know him and love him best as Wesley in The Princess Bride. Please welcome actor and New York Times best-selling author, Cary Elwes. Sadness of the passing of your friend Rob Reiner, the genius director behind this film. And I wonder if you could just start us with some remembrances of what he meant to you and what working on this film with him meant to you.
Well, it's still hard to process, Maurice. You know, what can I can't really boil down Rob into a sentence or even a few sentences other than to say, he was the most beautiful guy. He really was the most wonderful director I've ever worked with and will ever work with. This movie was pure magic to make. And I think that's why it connects with people. It has all of Rob's humor in it. It's the reason he wanted to make this film since he was a kid. Since he was 13, he'd been wanting to make it. And the film's themes, if you think about it, are true love, sacrifice, honor, and friendship. Yeah. Right? And these, and these are all things that were very important to Rob. Humor, obviously, is one of those things. But those four things were actually very important to Rob, and that's why he was the most important person, the perfect director to make this film. And he every day was a joy, every single day, Maurice. There wasn't a single day without laughter. I mean, look at this cast, between and our director, between Rob and Billy and Chris Guest. There was no end to it, every single day. So when you feel the joy watching this film, and you have moments where you get the little butterflies, that's what we were feeling while we were making it. And so when you watch this film and you feel all those things, you're feeling Rob, and so that's why I want to honor him.
You and I have talked many times about the making of this film, just in our private conversations. I know that you actually got hurt several times during the making of this film. Would you walk us through maybe the worst one?
Yes, I was very accident prone on this film. Well, very accident prone. Yes, the most serious accident. Okay, so disclaimer first. I take full responsibility for any of the accents. And don't be calling or emailing Disney, all right? Because I take full responsibility, okay? So they may have peripherally involved other people, Mo, but I take full responsibility. So the most serious accident involved the legendary Andre the Giant. How great is Andre? Andre was great in more ways than one, Mo. He wasn't just 7 foot four, 450 pounds. He was 7 foot four, 450 pounds of pure love. He always had a smile on his face. A real gentle giant. I always tell folks, you know, he was sweet enough to give you the shirt off his back. It'd be enough to put us all inside a tent. And he would give it to you. That's just who he was. And, but Andre lived in Andre's world, which, you know, being that big, he told me one day, he goes, you know, we live in different worlds. Your world and my world are very different. I said, well, can you share that with me? He started to tell me stories. He said, you know, he could never fit in the biggest bed in a hotel. They had to put them all together, and then maybe his feet wouldn't stick out of the end, right? Airplanes, if he flew commercial, he'd have to get the whole row to fit him. He could never take a bath. He would love to take a bath. There were no baths that could fit him. Swim in a pool. But cars, he had to have them modified. Otherwise, they'd be really low riders. Yeah. And so he said, you know, he had to adapt to our world. Even walking in through a regular door, he had to bend over double. So the first time you ever saw Andre coming through into a room, through a door, you saw the back of his head first. And then he stood up to his full height and he would take the breath, he would suck the air out of the room. People were just in awe. And you just had to have him walking in front of the sun and feeling the total eclipse happening. Or shaking your hand and feeling like your hand was six-month-old baby's hand inside a catcher's mitt. Or hugging you. He loved hugging people. I once watched him hug Robin Wright, and he hugged her, and he enveloped her. She disappeared. 1 minute Robin was there, and the next she was gone. Anyway, he couldn't fit in any regular trailer, and he certainly couldn't fit in the crew van coming up to the set. And both of his scenes that I had with him were quite high up. In fact, the area we used for a lot of sequences, a lot of scenes, was an area called the Peak District outside Sheffield. And there's one person from the Peak District, God bless you. And producers, and then there are some here tonight, will tell you that if they can use one location for multiple scenes, right? Right, Cassian? It's my brother's here tonight. Give it up for my brother. My brother would tell you that to save money, if you can use one location, because you don't have to pick up the whole crew and the trucks and the Jennies and the wardrobe and makeup and everything and move to another base camp. If they can settle in one area and shoot multiple scenes in one area, that's great. So when Rob was taken to the Peak District by Andy Scheinman, our producer, they told him, look, we can shoot a number of things here. We can shoot Carrie wrestling with Andre. We can shoot Carrie and Robin running out of the fire swamp, being chased by Humperdinck and Count Rugen. We can do that with both Chris's chasing after them. We can shoot the Iocane powder with Wally. All of these things could be done in the Peak District. Carrie rolling down the hill, which, by the way, if you go to the Peak District, that hill now is a tourist trap. People throw themselves off for money. Ridiculous. Anyway, so when Rob saw this location that Andy showed him, Rob went, and I'll do his voice just because because it's how I keep his spirit alive a little bit. He goes, "Oh, that's perfect. It's like a fairy tale, the hills, the clouds, perfect." And thank you.
It's the best rock line I've ever heard. It's also the only rock line I've ever heard, but it's great.
Thank you. But Andy Scheinman turned to Rob and went, "Yeah, well, how the heck are we going to get Andre up here?" And Rob went, "Oh, that's a good point. What are we going to do?" So they went down to his trailer, and we gave him a Mack truck for a trailer, because that's the only thing he could fit in. And he was quite happy in them. We gave him a sofa and TV and everything, quite happy, but he kept the back doors open. They go and knock on his trailer, and they said, "Andre, how do you get around on your farm?" Now, Andre had a farm in Ellerby, North Carolina, where he bred horses, which were like little miniature ponies next to him. But it was a big farm, and now it's a landmark. They put up one of those signs, you know, the signs that they put up usually for historical. Believe it or not, Ellerby actually put up, you can Google it, they put up a sign recently to honor Andre in Ellerby. It was pretty great. So they said to him, "Andre, how do you get around on your farm?" And Andre, without missing a beat, Mo, he goes, "I use an ATV, boss." So that's how he got around on his farm. You can Google it. And so they asked him what kind of ATV, because there's only a certain number of all-terrain vehicles that could support a giant. And he described to them this Honda that he needed, this very special three-wheeler Honda that was had big, big wheels, and it could support its weight, go up and down hills. And all-terrain vehicles in the UK were not a thing back then. They are now, but back in 1986 when we were shooting, it was really hard, certainly hard to find a Honda, a three-wheeler, right? So they put out the word to look for this thing, and they found one. And they told this guy to put it on the back of a trailer, Andy Scheinman did, and bring it to the set, and we'd rent it from him for all the scenes that Andre had in the Peak District. So this guy shows up with this trailer, this Honda three-wheeler, this red Honda three-wheeler. And Andre comes out, and he's happier than we've ever. He's like, like he's been waiting the whole time on the set for this thing to show up. And he gets on this thing, Mo, and he didn't use it to get to the location. He used it to ruin takes. There he is. And honestly, this is not a photograph that does it justice. It was like a little, it was like the puppet's tricycle and saw underneath it. Anyway, he took off on this thing. And by the way, when the owner saw him, took one look at Andre and went, you're buying that, mate, it's yours. We had to buy it. And he took off, and I was in the middle of shooting the scene with Robin up on the hill where I confront Buttercup about marrying Humperdinck. And we're doing a scene, and right in the middle of it, we hear this all-terrain vehicle coming over the hill. No muffler. The boom operator heard it first. He's like, huh? And over this hill comes Andre, really fast, like almost off the ground. Big grin, you could see all his teeth. Comes straight up to me, Mo. He goes, "Hey, boss." And Rob goes, "Okay, cut, it's Andre, cut." Just like that. He goes, "Boss." I go, "Yes, Andre." He goes, "You like my toy?" I said, "Yes, Andre. It looks like fun." He goes, "It is fun. You want to try it?" I said, "Well, Andre, I'm in the middle of shooting a scene right now." He didn't wait for me to finish my set. He just took off. And several crew members were dispatched to chase it, to stop it, because we couldn't shoot, because it had no muffler. We couldn't shoot with him going over the hills. So I want to give you the image of seven crew members chasing Andre up and down hills. It was like a Warner Brothers cartoon, I swear. Every so often, Andre would slow down to give them the impression they were catching up to him. And they go, "Andre, stop, Andre." And he would speed up again just as they got up to him. And then he'd turn around, you could hear him over the sound of this unmuffled baby, he'd go, ah. This went on for like 20 minutes. And Rob's like, this is gonna take a while. Finally, he goes over a hill far enough away that the sound guys go, okay, I think we can try it again. So we finish shooting that setup. We take time to sit in our chairs as they're moving the camera, and as they're setting up for the next shot, guess who shows up again? Exactly. Comes right up to me, and this is what he said. You know you want to. I'm having sense memory right now. So I asked the first AD how much time we had. I'd never been on an all-terrain vehicle. And he said a few minutes. I said, okay, great. So his bodyguard, I forgot to tell you, Andre had a bodyguard, yeah. This guy was like 5'2", not kidding. This guy, I actually asked him one day, what are you guarding him from, the flu? Comes up to me and he goes, oh, it's very easy, Governor, it's just like a motorbike. You know, you've ridden a motorbike, right? It's brakes, foot brake, handbrake, very important. On, off switch already on. Lights, don't need that, it's daylight. Clutch pedal, gears, easy, bobs your uncle. That was my first red flag. Second red flag was when Andre got off this thing and it went another 6 feet off the ground. Now I'm clambering on this thing and I had no business being on it. I've never ridden one before. And some of the crew are watching and it's uphill, I'm going uphill. I had put it in first gear, Mo. And I lurch forward, kind of shakily, and I went over a rock, and I caught my left big toe between the rock and the clutch pedal, and it bent my big toe all the way back till it touched the underside of my foot and snapped. That was what I was thinking, right then and there, and the thing stalled. And I could immediately realize, oh my God, I've just broken my toe. We're a week into shooting back. And we were supposed to shoot the sword fight scene with Mandy in about 12 days. And I thought, that's it, I'm fired. We're a week into shooting. They can easily replace me after a week. And I thought, that's it. It was so much fun while it lasted. Working with the great Rob Reiner. Bill Goldman, Norman Lear, it's over. Over. And as it stalled, some crew members came running up, including the set medic. Now, for those of you who don't know, every show, whether it's TV or film, has a medic on it, and this was no different. This lovely lady comes running up the hill, and she's got her medic's bag on her shoulder, Mo. And she comes up to me and she goes, What happened? I said, it's nothing, it's fine. Just a flesh wound. I was like, the Black Knight in Monty Python. I'm like, no, it's not kind of. She goes, let's have a look. I said, no, we don't have to. She goes, I think we better. So they took off my boot and then took off my sock, and there was the big toe dangling by its arm. And she went, ew. I don't think it's a medical term. She goes, oh, look, it's all the colors of the rainbow. I said, I know, is there anything you can do? And bless her heart, she opens her medic's bag. I remember it like yesterday. She opens her medic's bag and she goes, set nurse, I mean, I've got something for a tummy ache. If you got a tummy ache, she takes out a bottle and then she goes, I got some aspirin, but I don't suppose that'll make a difference. She goes, I've got Band-Aids. What do you want? It should be in the hospital. And I thought, if I went to the hospital, Mo, I thought that's when the producers and Rob would be like, leave him there. We'll just replace him, and that'll be that. And I was like, I can't go to hospital. I had to go finish the scene with Robin. In my head, I couldn't leave the set. I had to just get through it. So I said to her, is there anything you can do? Anything at all? And she looked at me, exasperated, like thinking, what's wrong with this guy? She goes, well, I suppose I could make a makeshift splint. I said, great, let's do that. So she opens her bag, and she takes out one of those wooden tongue depressors, you know, that doctors put in your mouth and make you go, ah? And she broke it in half, and she goes,
I suppose if I taped it to the other toes, they would look more normal.
And I'm thinking, great, I've got the best nurse in the world. This is all gonna work, right? It's insane. And she tapes it to the other toes, and now my big toe's really angry. It's the size of Andre's little toe. It's a huge thing, swollen, different color. And the boot won't fit, and the wardrobe's like, what are we gonna do? So they decide to cut the back of the boot with some heavy-duty shears and slip it on. And then they lift me to my feet and put me in the van to go back to the set. It's the longest ride I've ever taken in my life. Bumpy, it's hurting, and I'm like, what am I gonna do? The set nurse is in the seat behind me, and I overheard her say this to the first assistant director. She goes, I think he fell on his head as well. So I was distracted by that briefly, and then I thought, okay, I'm gonna see Rob, what am I gonna say, figure out what I'm gonna do. Before I could finish that thought, we arrived on the set. Someone pulled open the van door, and there was Rob standing right there in front of me. And his head was tilted, I'll never forget, his head was tilted. He had his headphones around his neck, his baseball cap, his big winter coat. And he's scratching his beard, looking at me, like this. And I leap out of the van, Mo, and I land on both feet, just eating the pain, like nothing. It's the best acting job I've ever done. Landing on my broken toe, and walk right up to him, no limp, nothing at all. And Rob says, hey, Gary, how you doing? Kind of like Joey in Friends. And I said, I'm good, Rob. How are you? And then he tilted his head the other way, Mo, like this. And he goes, I'm good. But how are you doing? And that's when I knew he knew, right? And I went, Rob, I'm so sorry. I feel like such a twit. I was fooling around on Andre's all-terrain vehicle. And I went over a rock, and I think I broke my big toe. And he goes, you think I don't know about it? It's been over the walkie-talkie for the last half hour, and the whole crew knows. I was really upset, and I was devastated. I said, I'm so sorry, Rob, I feel like such a twit. He goes, why didn't you tell me? I said, Rob, I was afraid you would fire me. And then he said something that warms my heart. Now, more than ever, he said, fire you? How can I fire you? You're the only guy who could play Wesley. Isn't that sweet? That's wrong.
And he's right.
So he said, can you walk? I said, yes. He said, can you run? I said, it'll be an interpretive dance. He said, well, we'll move the fight scene with you and Manny to the end of the schedule, and that'll give you time to heal, which is what we did. And, you know, you can see some of my interpretive dancing. And running into the fire swamp is something that Twyla Tharp would be really proud of. And in fact, I finished that scene with Robin up on the hill where I confront her marrying Humperdinck, and I put my hands behind my head, and in one take, I did this absurd thing by lifting my foot up to protect it. And Rob came up to me after the take and he goes, that thing you did with your foot is so elegant. How did you come up with it? Oh, right, the toe. But I learned two valuable things that day. One, always tell the truth right away, it's easier. And second was, all-terrain vehicles are not toys, despite what Andre said. They're not. So that's how that went down. That's
great. What a great day.
Well, that was a week into shooting. That was a week into shooting, yeah. And I'll never been on another all-terrain vehicle. That's it. Never.
You have a story, though, about the first day with Andre. Is that...
First day with Andre. Well, we shot out of sequence. We shoot everything out of sequence. For those of you who don't know, who are not in the business, every show is shot out of sequence. Again, for financial reasons. You get a location for a certain period of time, and you shoot all the scenes that are in that location, whether they're at the beginning of the movie, the middle of the movie, end of the movie, doesn't matter. So we had Hever Castle, which was doubling for Humperdinck's castle. And we only had it for a short period of time. And that's where the wedding is, where he presents everyone to the crown, Buttercup to the crown, and all the interior of Humperdinck's office and the bridal suite, all of that's at Hever. And we had to shoot the storming of the castle. And we shot this very early on with Andre. And they built this fabulous fake castle wall, Mo, for us to lean against and then plan our attack of storming the castle, right? And they had to lift it, they had to build it on a scaffold so that our DP, Adrian Biddle and Rob, could see Hever in the background and the flags and everything. So they had to be built up to a certain height. So it was about twice the size of this carpet, and it had steps going down, let's say on this side, to Video Village. And where I'm sitting is where the camera was, where you are is where the boomer operator was. So we all come up the steps onto the set, and Rob placed us, and he's like, Andre, you kneel down, because otherwise we won't see you, so we've got to kneel down nice and low. Gary, you'd be mostly dead there, we'll talk about that. And Mandy, what do you want to do? Mandy's deciding he's going to crouch. And then Rob calls me aside, down to Video Vision. He wants to discuss what I want to do for being mostly dead, because we hadn't discussed it. And I said, well, I think it'd be fun, Rob, if Wesley is like a marionette. If he's mostly dead, his head works first, right? But his neck is not great. I said, wouldn't it be fun if we allow Fezzik to grab my head and nod for me, right? And because then you'd see this these fabulous hands that Andre had. Because I'd seen him keep Robin Wright warm in the Peak District by putting his hand over her head and her whole face disappeared. And I said, wouldn't it be... And Rob's like, that's great. And he goes over to Andre, says, Andre, I want you to treat him like a puppet and you make him upset when he's upset. And then he nod for him. And, great. So we go up, back up to the platform, and they line up the shot, and Rob goes back down to Video Village and he yells sound speed, he yells action. And you guys know the lines better than I do, but I think Fezzik says, I wonder how long before it takes effect. And Montoya says, your guess is as good as mine. And then I come to and I say, I'll fight you both apart. Fight you both together, I'll beat you both apart. Something like that, right? Yeah. Thank you. And then Fezzik says, I guess not very long, because I've come to. Well, Andre didn't get to the word long when he let out the most monumental fart. And when I say monumental, I mean of all time. I'm amazed that you didn't hear it. Maybe it was mistaken for an earthquake here. But I gotta tell you, the whole plywood set was shaking. Shaking. I kid you not. It was... Chris Guest was there, he timed it, 16 seconds. And it was magnificent. And so everyone had to grab something to hold on to while we were shaking, right? And the other one was to protect at least one eardrum, right? And I looked over at the sound guy and he'd taken his headphones off. That's too much. And then I looked over at Andre and he was leaning back against the wall, though. And he was eyes shut, big smile, swaying back and forth, like he was letting go of something he'd been holding on to for way too long. And for some reason, I kid you not, for some reason, there was steam coming out of the top of his head. To this day, I don't know why. But it was the seismic, right? And it was the full orchestra. Of course, it was all about that bass and the wind. I've heard the wind section, of course. But there were trombones and flutes. At one point, there was a piccolo. It was like a... And Chris Guest, the whole time, is timing it, watching. And, you know, I'm from England, and, you know, it's different in England, the way people deal with other people. farting. It's, in England, you know, here it's like, oh, dude, take it out, so I open it. In England, they're like, they blame someone. They're like, is there a storm coming in all the time? But this wasn't like any fart that anyone on the crew had ever experienced. They were absolutely stunned into silence when it was over. Stunned silence. When he let out the last little part of the fart and it was done, Chris Guest told me later, he said, no birds were singing. Nothing. Nothing. Everyone had a stunned look on their face, all of us. And Rob broke the ice. Rob said, hey, Andre, you okay? That's what he said. And Andre, without missing a beat, Mo, said, I am now, boss.
First day. First take.
Needless to say, we got to take two when he gets to the line.
I guess not very long.
I'm lying there with my eyes closed going, oh God, please let it be gone. So that scene now is known as the storming of the castle. For real. Yeah. I must tell you, I ran into... There was a guy called Frenchie who ran his farm in Ellaby, North Carolina. And I shared the story with Frenchie. I said about the farm, 16 seconds, and no birds, and all that. And Frenchie goes, oh yeah, Andre loved to break the ice by breaking wind. I'm like, he planned that? Crazy.
For me, I honor writers in my work. To me, the writer is the most important thing. And on this film, of course, you have the great William Goldman.
Yes.
Which Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, Adventures in the Screen Trade. What was your relationship with Bill Goldman like? You've talked about him.
Well, he loomed very large in our house. My father took my brothers and myself to see Butch Cassidy. He loved that movie. And so we were watching it with our dad, and he was laughing at everything. We thought, oh my God, who is this? First of all, fell in love with the movie. If you haven't seen it, you must see it. But then we realized the lines in it, the dialogue, the way it was written. Bill Goldman, we're like, Bill Goldman. He became like this thing. And so I read the book when I was 13. And I loved it. And I found out when I met Rob that he'd read it when he was 13. And like I said earlier, that's when he decided he was going to make it into a movie. But no one wanted to make it. And Goldman said to me, he said, no one, I tried. Seven people, seven studios, seven producers came to me, seven different studios. He said, one studio folded over it. They lost all their money and folded. He actually said, I was instrumental in closing down the studio with this film. And you know, at one point he had Jimmy Stewart attached. He had Arnold Schwarzenegger attached to play Fezzik. All these different iterations. He had great directors attached. He had François Truffaut, the French New Wave director, attached. He had the British director John Borman was attached at one point. Many directors wanted to make it. None of them could get it off the ground. So when Rob had finished Spinal Tap, which was a massive hit, right? Yeah. Massive. First mockumentary ever made, and never to be beaten by anyone. And he'd done The Sure Thing, and he was already a rising star as a director. And so he went to visit the head of the studio, and the head of the studio said to Rob, we want to make whatever Rob Reiner wants. Whatever movie you want to make, we here want to make it. And Rob went, well, I want to make The Princess Bride. And the studio head said, anything but that. And Rob's like, well, you just asked me what I wanted to make. That's what I want to make. And they said, no. So finally, Rob went to see Norman Lear, the great Norman Lear. Yeah.
His old boss. Yeah.
Who had discovered Rob and put him in All the Family. And they'd become, Rob used to describe Norman as his second father. And Norman really believed in Rob and loved Rob, and he financed Spinal Tap. And Rob managed to convince Norman to finance the Princess Bride himself. Yeah. Rob got him to write a check for $16 million in 1986 dollars, which is, you do the math. And it was the first time anyone had ever financed a film of that size with their own money, which is a very risky thing to do. And especially with unknowns like myself and Robin, that could never happen today, never. And so I was always in debt to Norman for that. But he would say to me every time I saw him, he'd go, "Gary, it was the best investment I ever made." You know, and so he was a wonderful, wonderful guy, Norman. And you know, we owe a lot to him. He was a titan in this business. I mean, look at the shows he created, All in the Family, Archie Bunker's House, The Jeffersons. I mean, a legend, an absolute legend, and a real sweetheart. Anyway.
Changed the face of television.
Changed the face.
Changed society.
Right, he did.
Changed the way we think.
Right? And you could never get away with a character like Archie Bunker today. But he made us really think about it. Anyway, I forget.
You made a second trip to the hospital.
I did.
During this film. You want to talk about that?
Okay.
Have we got time?
Sure. Oh, God, it's so embarrassing. Okay, again, I take full responsibility. Okay? This involved peripherally the great Chris Guest, who I mentioned. How great is Chris? I'll tell you how funny Chris is. You all know how funny he is, but how funny he is to work with. And he's very, very quiet with his jokes. He's not a big, he's very different than Billy. He's very quiet, very subtle. His jokes are very deep and very powerful, but they're subtle. And he never laughs out loud. He never has a full down crazy laugh. This is the sound of Chris Guest losing it. You ready? Here it is. That's Chris losing it. And I'll never forget, we were sitting on the set and going through our picture kills, our publicity kills, which for those of you who don't know, it's when the actors go through all the photographs from the stills photographer and they decide which ones are kills not to be used and which ones the actors would like to use for the publicity. And I'm sitting next to Chris, and he's looking at his photographs, and he comes across one of him as Reuben on the horse, and he goes, and I go, "Ooh, gold." I said, "What is it, Chris?" He goes, "Look." And he hands me the photograph, Mo. And it's Reuben sitting on the horse, and Chris is funny doing nothing, and it's amusing, but I'm not sure why he's losing the plot. And I said to him, "What?" And he goes, "Look at the horse." And he points to the horse's mouth, Mo. And the horse, for the first time I noticed, has giant buck teeth. And he goes, "It's perfect." That's the kind of crazy set I was on. Just craziness. Anyway, so I only had two scenes with Chris. One was The Pit of Despair, where he puts me on the machine. And the other is when we meet for the first time coming out of the fire swamp, and I notice he has six fingers on his hand. And he has to hit me with the butt of his sword and knock me out. So we're setting up, we're outside this area called Burnham Woods, and it's a long way away from Shepton, where we're doing all the interior scenes. And we're setting up the shot and doing the makeup and the hair and all of that, and wardrobe. And as I'm getting prepared, the two props guys come up to me. And they go, "Governor, can we have a word, please?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And they pull me aside. And I'm wondering what this is about. And one of them says, "Governor, we've got a bit of a problem." I go, "What?" They go, "We forgot a prop sword." I said, "What?" He goes, "We forgot the prop swords." I said, "What do you mean?" They go, "We forgot to bring them." I said, "Guys, this is a conversation for the director. You know, let's go talk to Rob." So So I take them over to Video Village where Chris is and Rob. And I said, guys, tell Rob what you just told me. And they said, Governor, we're so sorry. We forgot a prop sword. And Rob's like, I don't understand. I mean, he pulls out the call sheet and he looks at it. And the call sheet has everything on it. You know, it has what time everyone shows up for work, all the actors, the crew, and what wardrobe, what makeup, what props, what sets. And he looks at me and goes, it says here, prop swords for Count Rugen. I don't understand. What happened? He said, well, Governor, you know, sometimes we make mistakes and we left them at the studio. And Rob's like, well, the studio, the Shepperton, right? And they go, yeah. The Shepperton's 3 hours away. This is the last shot of the day and we're losing the light. And there's no way to drive 3 hours, pick up the prop swords, drive another 3 hours and get this shot. There's no way it's going to happen. So Rob goes, well, what are we gonna do? So our stunt coordinator, the great Peter Diamond, who's no longer with us, steps forward and goes, Mr. Reiner, I think I have a solution. And Rob's like, I'm all ears, what do you got? And Peter says, if we put Gary in front of the camera and put him far enough away, all Chris has to do is swipe frame. You guys know where this is going? Swipe frame with the real sword. Carry, all he has to do is whip his head at the exact moment, it'll look like a real hit. And Rob's like, okay, can we do that? And these swords, by the way, that he and Chris Sarandon are riding around with on their horses, they're real swords. They're not sharp, but they're heavy. And they were heavy for a reason. They want to look real. And Chris is like, I'm not doing that. That way. And I'm like, I've already broken my toe at this point. I'm like, what could possibly happen, right? I'm like, Chris, it's fine. They're going to keep me far enough away from me. It's fine. You just swipe camera on, do that, and we'll be... He's like, I don't know. So we set up the shot. And we do a practice take. And Chris swipes frame with the butt of the sword, and I wet my head, and I'm like, okay, all right, let's try one. And Rob's like, okay, let's do it. So we shoot the first take, cut... Camera operator goes like that. And Rob's like, what's wrong? And the operator says to him, well, Carrie whipped his head too soon. We could tell the sword didn't hit him. So Rob comes up and says, Carrie, you gotta wait for the sword to pass in front of your head, and then you whip it, okay? Yeah, that was his direction. He always come and tell him. And I said, okay, we'll do a second take. Second take, same thing. Operator, no good. Rob's like, what now? Because he could only see so much on his little Video Village monitor. And the operator said, well, it looks like Carrie stepped too far back. We need to bring him closer. And Chris gets like, he's fine where he is. And I'm like, how far? And the operator goes, maybe half inch, maybe three quarters of an inch. And Rob's like, Gary, can you do that? Chris, can you do maybe three quarters, half inch, three quarters? Okay. I said, it's fine, I'll do it. Chris, like, I don't know, man. Third take. In the script, it says, Count Rugen hits the man in black with his sword. Screen goes to black. Well, my screen went to black because he knocked me out cold. And that's the take in the movie. Really, he goes, it's the only one that worked. You were done for the day after that. I woke up, Mo, in the hospital in Sheffield, lying on an operating table in my full Dread Pirate Roberts costume, right? Sans head dress, sans mask, lying on the table. I came to from the anesthetic wearing off. To this doctor leaning over me, sewing up this little hole in my head, right? To wearing glasses, he's got a mask on, scrubs, the whole thing. And I realize it's the same doctor who treated me for my toe. It's true. And this is what he said to me, God's honest truth, this is what he said. He goes, you're very accident prone, aren't you, Zorro? Thank you.
got TV, apparently. We've got some audience questions.
Great. Let's do it.
Should we let me know?
Let's do it. Let's bring up the lights, yeah. Oh, my gosh, look, it's a full house. Oh, you guys, God bless you.
It's a full house.
God bless you.
Why would my be? My God. Our first question is from Rory from London, England.
Oh my gosh, Rory. Where are you?
Where are you, Rory?
Open up your arm.
Stand over where?
Up there. Hey, Rory.
What part of London? Can you do that?
Brixton?
Yeah. Brixton.
Brixton, yeah.
Yeah.
Right on.
You got that accent down? I don't think I do. Okay, he wants to know, did you take anything home with you from the set?
You know,
confession time.
Confession, Rory, I don't believe in taking things. If I do, I always ask the prop department or the set deck. But in this case, for some reason, I didn't take anything home. I did give Rob Reiner my sword at the end because I felt that was appropriate as a parting gift. And he kept it. He took it with him, put it on his office, and then finally took it home and put it above the mantle. And Norman Lear felt so bad that I didn't have anything that he gave me a replica of the sword. So I have a replica, which was very nice. So give it to me. Right. Yeah.
Our next question is from Kayla Steele from Santa Clarita, California.
Kayla, is that right?
Kayla?
Where are you, Kayla? Hi, Kayla. Hi,
Santa Clarita. Question, what was, also we should mention that it's her parents' 29th anniversary.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations.
So she wants to know, what was your most physically challenging scene in the movie?
Well, I mentioned both. Everything after the broken toe. Everything after the hole in my head. So yeah, it was, needless to say, Rob would say after that, anytime there was a stunt, they'd be like, you know, Gary, maybe you should let the stunt double do it, you know? So yeah, they didn't let me do any stunts after the second hospital visit. Set one, just one, the diving into the pit. The lightning set in the firestorm. That Andy Bradford, my double, did it, where he stuck the sword in the ground, held his nose, and jumped in ass first. And I was standing by the monitor with Rob, and I said, Rob, that doesn't look very heroic. And Rob's like, you know, he's the stunt double. That's what he does. And I said, can I try it? You know, and all the stunt people and the special effects were like, no, Governor, don't let him do it. He breaks his neck. We all go on, Governor. We all go on. And Rob's like, you know, you've got to listen. This is what these guys are saying. You know, if you break your neck, he's right. We all go home. I said, Rob, one take. Just let me have one take. I swear to God I can do it. So he goes, one. You get one. That's it. And then we're moving on. And Andy can do it. So I asked Andy how it worked. I get to the scene where Robin disappears and I panic. I put the sword on the ground. I cut the piece of vine, put the sword on the ground, jump in, take the vine with me, perfect dive right in. That's the take in the movie. Luck. Sheer luck.
And we have a question here from Kyle from San Clemente. Kyle, where are you? All right.
Hey, Kyle.
Kyle's question. Did the cast, while shooting, take the movie seriously, or was it initially viewed as a silly movie?
That's a good question, Kyle. So at the table read, after we finish reading the whole script with Bill Goldman was there. Buck Henry, for some reason, was in the room. I know, amazing. He happened to be in London at the time, and Rob and Bill loved him, and they invited him along to get his thoughts. When we finished the table read, Rob said to the whole cast, he said, now listen,
This script does seem silly at times. There's very silly things that happen. Robin Buttercup is the only one that is dealing with real drama. The rest of you do very silly things, right? He said, but I want you to remember that you have to play your cards very close to your chest. In other words, don't tear it. Don't play it for laughs. You don't have to. It's all there in the writing and in the action. You don't have to force it. And so that was a great note for all of us. That's how we played it. So that's a very good question, Lori.
And so when The Princess Bride came out, it's hard to realize this looking back, but it was not a hit. It was not a hit in 1987.
No. At all.
Yeah. When did you know that this film was a big success?
Well, we thought it was going to be massive, of course, because how could it possibly fail? We had the great Rob Reiner coming off, as I mentioned, Spinal Tap and Sure Thing. He just was editing Stand By Me, which he showed me. He actually gave me a private screening in a theater all to myself to watch, and I was blown away. I thought it was the most beautiful film I'd seen in a long time. And, we had Bill Goldman, an Oscar-winning screenwriter for All the President's Men, and Butch Cassidy. We had Norman Lear, the legendary Norman Lear we just mentioned. We had a real giant. We had all these great actors, Billy, Chris Guest, Chris Sarandon, Carol Kane. The list goes on, right? So we thought we had something. And we flew to Toronto for the Toronto Film Festival. We opened the picture there in September of 87. And we all got there and screened the movie. And it was a hit there at the festival. They gave us the Best Audience Reaction Award, which I didn't know there was a category. Maybe it's gone now, but they had one back then. And we got on the plane to go open the picture in Manhattan. We're all buoyant. We're like, okay, TIFF, they loved us. It's good. It's a good sign. So we flew to Manhattan to open the picture there. And when we landed at JFK, Rob was spirited away by an assistant who met us at the airport and told him there was a call he had to take from L.A. And this was before cell phones, so they took him into one of those airport lounges and he had to take a physical phone, an old phone, right? Took the call, and we all waited for him in the hallway. And after he finished the call, though, he came out and he was depressed. I mean, completely depressed. And I have to tell you about Rob, that Rob really wore his heart on his sleeve. If he was happy, he laughed, and he was buoyant like a little kid. And if he was sad, it was like, the best way I could describe it was like, you know how Charlie Brown had that little cloud over him and it raining when he was walking with his head? Just like that. So when he came out, he was all like that, all bummed. I'm like, Rob, what is it? He goes, no, it's nothing, it's nothing. And we knew it was something, right? We all get in the cars and we go to a dinner that Rob has organized for us in Manhattan. And what was gonna happen was we would have the dinner with the cast, with him, and then we would all go to the theater and go on stage and Rob would introduce us on a stage like this to the audience, right? So we go to the dinner, and at the end of the dinner, Rob gets up to make a speech. And he said, some of you may notice I took a call today. And he proceeds to tell a story that he got a call from an executive at the studio who told him that the picture was not gonna perform. Now, for those of you who don't know, most of you do, I'm sure, studios don't, when they open a movie on a weekend, on a Friday or whatever, they don't wait till Monday to find out if it's gonna make money or not. They wanna know right away. And they do that by crunching the numbers. They find out it's pre-sales, how many people have bought tickets or shown interest in it. They test it. And they know from test screening and pre-sales, from crunching the numbers, they know already. They wanna know on Friday if they've lost, if they bet the farm and lost it. And he got the call saying, numbers are not gonna, it's not gonna work. And so he was really bummed. And so were we. We're like, what? He's like, no, it's okay, it's okay. And it wasn't. We were all really upset. And he said something so beautiful. He goes, I just want you to know that I'm really proud of this picture, and I'm proud of all of you in it, and if I had an opportunity to make it again, I'd do it all over again with all of you. And we were, people were crying. Robin was absolutely in tears, you know, and we were really upset about it. He's like, it's okay, she was hugging him, and we all tried to console us, and then we had to come to the theater and like put on smiles and introduce our, be introduced by Rob on stage, you know. We get through that, and you know, it was a charade. We're putting on a face like we're all confident. We were just devastated. So then we had to get on with our lives. You have to move on, you know. If a movie doesn't perform, it doesn't perform. There's nothing you can do about it. And so, about a year later, something magical happened. Film was released on this early invention called VHS. Yes. Raise your hands if you ever had a copy of the VHS. Oh my God, what, wow. Oh my gosh. All right, how many of you have working VCRs, really? That's LA. There's always some enterprising person here who knows how to fix a VCR. They always break. Well, what these lovely folks will tell you, Mo, is that when this film came out on VHS, first you could rent it, then you could buy it, but families sat down and watched it together, and it became this keepsake. It was a moment where everyone enjoyed the film together. The adults got something out of it, the kids got something out of it, and it was a moment where they all huddled around the TV set, and they all remember watching it together. That's what I hear from people. And it became this phenomenon, this film, literally, for lack of a better phrase, that had been mostly dead. Right? Suddenly had life. And people, I hear stories from folks saying, you know, they would lend out their copy to neighbors and friends. Some neighbors and friends didn't return it, and they were no longer neighbors and friends. And it was passed down from generation to generation and became like this family heirloom, like this keepsake. And I meet folks who want me to sign copies, and they're like, it belonged to my grandmother, and the tape's coming out like a cat's fur ball, you know. But thanks to all of everyone who took this film to their hearts on VHS, we suddenly had a hit. It was massive, like bigger than the studio could possibly imagine. And I think it was actually New Line who released yeah. New Line very happy about that decision. Anyway, suddenly our lives changed. I'll never forget Billy said he could never walk into a deli again without someone going, "You want that lean, Mr. Crystal? Lean? Mutton lettuce, tomato lean." Mandy said he couldn't walk down the street without some kid going, "Say it." I was in a restaurant in Manhattan, and I was ordering a hamburger, and the waitress said, "How do you want that cooked?" And I said, "Medium rare." And she just went, "As you wish." And I'd never heard anyone say that to me before. So I looked up at her and I said, I'm so sorry, what did you say? And she just went, "You know." But you know who gets it the worst? Wally. He said, "Carrie, you got it easy. You got three words that mean I love you." He said, "I have one word, one." He said, "Barely a minute goes by in his day." And he started to share. I could lay it on me. He said, "Carrie, if I'm at an airport and I'm late to the gate and the plane's about to take off, if I get there just in time, when the flight attendant closes the gate, what do you think she says to me as she's closing it?" He said, "If I'm in a hotel, checked in, get my bags, go to the elevator. If I don't make the elevator in time, there are people in it, and the door's closing," he goes, "do you think they press door open?" "No, they don't. They all lean as the door's closing, and they go,
inconceivable."
said if he's running to a cab in Manhattan, someone beats him to it. They close the door with... He said, Carrie, if I drop my wallet, someone is there. Either whispering it in my ear or screaming it at me from across the street. He says, you want to know something weird? I go, there's something weirder than that? He said, yeah. Everyone thinks I'm hearing it for the first time. So, I'll tell you what's inconceivable. What's inconceivable is almost 40 years later, you guys all showed up and packed this theater to come and share this movie together in a theater. And that, honestly, is inconceivable to me. It really is.
That's good. That's what you are. You're an ambassador of love.
So I feel a great responsibility because we're all here because we love love. We love true love. And you know, there's a lot of not so much good things going on in the world. So I'm here to deputize all of you to be ambassadors of love. So, practice random acts of kindness and share love with the world because we need it today more than ever. I really believe that, right? I want you to put your hands together for our great moderator, Maurice LaMarche. Also, give a big hand to the Wilshire Ebel Theater, all the wonderful staff, volunteers. This is a non-profit theater, so please support your theater. I want to thank Netflix is a Joke Festival for putting on this show tonight, Live Nation, and all of you for coming out on a Monday. On a Monday. I love you, as you wish. Thank you.